Let's get underway looking at Deuteronomy 33 and 34 to wind up this book of Deuteronomy and also ends the Pentateuch. We've been studying Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and now we're finishing Deuteronomy. We have finished Moses when we finish this tonight. So we're starting into the history section next time, and that is we'll be looking at Joshua. This is our outline. Wearsby outlines this as in four sermons, and we are in that last section, the personal concerns. Moses looks up. Four sections he puts into that in his outline, the new leader, the new song last week, and tonight we're talking about a new blessing and a new home. That's typical of Wearsby's way of outlining. I might word that a little bit different, but a good analysis. Let's one last time review our chapters of where we've been, and then we'll get underway with 33 and 34. Chapter 1, the first sermon. All right. And chapter 2? All right. And then chapter 3? All right, here's in chapter 3, Moses is forbidden to enter into the land, and then we see tonight that that comes true. He's not allowed to enter, he can see it, but he's not allowed to enter. Chapter 4 ends the first sermon, and necessity of obedience, that's the first sermon. All right, the second sermon starts in chapter 5 with 10 commandments and the people fear God. Very good. Chapter 6, a broader view. All right, chapter 7, yeah, you're a distinct people. All right, chapter 8, yeah, more about obedience. You see this all throughout every sermon. Chapter 9, yes, that has to do with their not thinking, don't think you're going to get this land on your own merit. It's not because of you, it's because of God and because of the wickedness of the people. Chapter 10. More about obedience. Very good. Chapter 11. More about obedience. Chapter 12 stands out. Place that God chooses. Worshiping as God directs. God has a place that he chooses, and that would start with Shiloh and later become Jerusalem. All right. Chapter 13. All right. Chapter 14. All right, very good. Chapter 15. Yeah, that's 7-year release. Good. Chapter 16. Annual feast. Chapter 17. And a king. Very good. Chapter 18. All right, yes. Levite portion, etc., and a prophet like unto Moses. Chapter 8, that was 18. 19. Cities of refuge. We'll see more about those in the book of Joshua, by the way. We got a taste of that here in chapter 19. Chapter 20, rules of warfare. And then 21 and 22, miscellaneous laws. That's the best way we can group those. 23, all right. And then chapter 24, ought to stand out because it deals with divorce. All right, we're getting close to the end. Chapter 25, more focusing primarily on fairness. Chapter 26, all right, that ends the second sermon. Now we start the third sermon in chapter 27. Yeah, the covenant renewal, chapter 28. Yeah, blessings and curses, and that's going to come to play a little bit later on. Chapter 29, yeah, renewing the covenant, and chapter 30. All right, that's the end of the third sermon. All right, so now we're ready for the fourth and final sermon, which started in 31, and in 31 we have Moses' farewell, chapter 32, the Song of Moses, and then we're ready for chapter 33. All right, what's chapter 33 about? All right, it has to do with blessings of for Israel. Some call it the blessings of Moses because Moses pronounced the blessings, but these are the blessings of God upon Israel. And so we're going to see more about that in a second. One last time, let's look at this, and that is, this is the point of the fourth sermon that begins with 33, chapter 31 through 33, and then chapter 34 is about Moses, is not part of the sermon. It's a new leader and future challenges. And chapter 32 and 33, I think, are companion chapters, and you'll see what I mean by that here in just a second. All right, chapter 33, call it Blessings for Israel. And this seems to be like the song that we had in chapter 32. And so they are companion chapters. Not all chapters are companion chapters. What I mean by that, sometimes they either mirror one another or they are dealing with opposite concepts like darkness and light, 1 John 1, 1 John 2 are companion chapters. So these chapters are companion chapters in this sense that the song focuses on the warnings about departure. They're going astray. They're coming back. Their apostasy, it's more, and I put in quotations, more negative in its nature, and that's needed. The blessings of chapter 33 are written much like a song. It's not labeled as a song like chapter 32 is, but it's much like a song, but it's on the opposite side of that, not in contradiction of chapter 32, but it focuses on potential and the more positive, if I might put that in quotation. Track in with me? All right. So it is the equalizing point. Now, let me stop and footnote. From that I learned, let me get to my practical lesson first. From that I learned that there's a place for positive, there's a place for negative. There's a place to warn, and there's a place to talk about potential. There's a place to condemn, and there's a place to encourage. And keeping that balance is not always easy, but it's essential. It's like dealing with your children. You want to rebuke them sternly when they need, but you also want to build them up and encourage their potential and what they can do. You don't want to beat them down all the time, nor do you want to encourage them all the time and never correct. There's a place for balance. Moses does that in his last sermon. That's quite interesting to me. All right, chapter 33. Let's start with God's glorious scene in giving the law. Now, there's quite a bit of practical things to learn right here in chapter 33. And a lot of it is learned right here in the first eight verses. So let's see what we've got right here, our first five verses. God's glory is seen in giving the law. So here's the picture of verses 1 to 5 of God coming in His power and His might and delivering a law to them. And that's what Moses was all about. So starting in Exodus, going into Numbers, Leviticus, and then Numbers and Deuteronomy, the emphasis has been on the law and obedience to the law. So to start at verse 1. Now, this is the blessing which Moses, the man of God. Now, that expression, the man of God, is new to us in the book of Deuteronomy. So some suggest, and probably so, that chapter 31 to 34 is an addendum to the book. Probably written by someone else, maybe Joshua. I have no issue with that. And if so, then Joshua was inspired in writing it. Some think it was Ezra at a much later time. I don't think so. But if it was, then he's inspired. And that's no question of inspiration. But it refers to Moses as a man of God. And that's one of the reasons that that hasn't been done thus far in the book. But that's another question for another time. That he blessed the children of Israel before his death. And here's what he said. So here's verse 1 and 2. That God visited his people in giving a law. So it pictures God. He came from Sinai. This is written in poetic form, by the way, much like the song. And dawned on them from Mount Seir and shone on them from Mount Paran. These are all referring to the same place. And then he came with 10,000 of his saints. So here's the picture of God coming, just storming out of the mountains and bringing 10,000 of his saints, probably a reference to angels. And from his right hand, he gave them a fiery law for them. So all it's doing is picturing God ushered in with power and with might and as a royal king coming forth, delivering this fiery law to them. He gave them a law. All right? So here's the first practical thing that I learned from that. If you want to go to question number 8 and you don't have anything yet, I'm learning from that the law was a blessing for Israel. It's not a curse. And if God gives us a law, that's a blessing. It's not a curse. Now, some people think that God gives me a restriction. God says, don't do this, and here's something that's sinful, then that's a curse, and that means that I'm limited and I'm bound. It's a blessing for God to give us direction and law. And God is pictured as ushered out, coming with His might and with His 10,000s of angels, and with His strong right hand. The right hand always means strength. God, with His strength and His might and His power, brought a law. Now verse 3. Why did He do that? Because of His law. Wasn't because of hate. Wasn't because He wants to make man uncomfortable. Because He wants to make man miserable. Because He wants to condemn man. He gave him a law. Look at verse 3. Yes, He loves the people, all the saints of his land. And they sit down at His feet and everyone receives His word. And so the people are glad to receive the message. And so why did He do that? Because He cares about His people. He gave them a law so that, as we saw earlier, chapter 7, to make them a separate, distinct people. Otherwise, they're going to amalgamate into the community of the people and be no different. Now, verse 4. What does verse 4 say about this law? Yeah, it's a rich inheritance. It's pictured, if you could imagine, you've got this great uncle that died, or maybe it's your granddad that died, and he was filthy rich, and he left you a mighty inheritance. And what would that feel like that you got this is an inheritance? Verse 4. Verse 4 pictures that Moses commanded the law a heritage of the congregation of Jacob. God pictures it as a great inheritance that He gives to us. And you think, man, that'd be something to get this millions of dollars. God gave you something worth more than that. He gave you the word. That's powerful. Verse 5 now. Say again. God's their ruler. Yeah, He was king in Jeshurun. Now, do you remember Jeshurun? We saw that in chapter 32. So you might go back to verse 15. You might have made a marginal note there. Jeshurun means righteousness, and it refers to Israel. And it is often used as a rebuke to Israel, calling them righteous because that's what they were supposed to be, though they were not always that. All right? So he's talking about Israel. So at verse 5, he was king in Jeshurun, or Israel, when the leaders of the people were gathered, all the tribes of Israel gathered. In other words, God's their king. Do you see a connection with God being their king and giving them the law? When they submit to the law, God is their ruler. When we submit to the law of God, then Christ is our ruler. Why do you call me? Say it again. Who said that? Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say. Remember that? All right. So verses 1 to 5 sets the pace for verses 6 down through verse 25. The blessings that are pronounced. So God gave you a rich inheritance. God gave you this great blessing of the law. God is your ruler. Now then, here are the blessings for the tribes. Question number 2. What tribe's not mentioned here? Simeon. Reckon why? All right, very good. Yeah, they are not mentioned. Simeon is not mentioned in the list here. And the reason for that being, they were scattered because of the case with Dinah. Genesis 49, verses 5 to 7. If you want to make a marginal note and flag that in your text. They were given a small portion in Judah. So you'll see maps, and I don't have one to show you tonight. But when we start dividing the tribes, we're going to see a big area labeled Judah, and then there's a little area in the middle of that, Simeon. Remember that? All right. You might have maps in the back of your Bible showing that. You might flip over there and see it. Joshua 19, 2 through 9 is where that happens. And we'll get to that in Joshua. But they did get, the Levites had a place to live, but they were scattered among the people, you remember. They're not given a territory. And so Simeon is given a small territory within Judah. But they're scattered because of that case in Genesis 49. All right, let's get underway. And so let's go to question, get ready for question 3. We'll take each one of these as we come to them. And we're going to see what's said about each one of these tribes. He starts with Reuben. And what did he say about Reuben? All right. Reuben will live and not die. In other words, Reuben is not going to die out. The tribe is not going to die out. But their numbers would diminish. But even though they diminish, they eventually flourish. I think that's the point. Now let's see that their numbers diminish. Numbers chapter 1, I'm not going to take the time to turn there, but Numbers chapter 1 and 21, they had something like 46,000 people in the tribe. That was the first census. Over in Numbers 26:7, they had 43,000. I don't remember the exact number, but around 3,000 something difference. All right? So they diminished in number, but even though they diminished in number, they're going to increase eventually, and they're not going to die out. So some of the blessings here are not great, profound blessings in the sense that this tribe is going to become great because of this king coming out of it, and then this tribe is going to become great because of this warrior coming out of it. It's simply the counterpart of these warnings of chapter 32, if that makes sense. So there is warnings about apostasy, but there is great potential here in chapter 33. There is potential. Y'all can go places. You can flourish. You go back to this law that you were given a blessing with. You follow that and things are going to go well. You can flourish. So Reuben, what about you? Well, you're going to flourish even though, and you're not going to die out. All right, what about Judah? Question 3B. All right. What's interesting now is what's not said about Judah. It doesn't say that the Messiah is going to come out of Judah. You would think, you know, Judah, you may have some problems and go astray, but ultimately out of you is going to be the rise of the Messiah. Doesn't mention that. That's not mentioned at all. But what he does mention is God will hear their cry. That hear, Lord, the voice of Judah and bring him to his people and let his hands be sufficient. And you may help against his enemy. And that's basically all that's said about Judah. So Reuben, you're not going to die out, but you'll eventually increase even though you diminish in number. Judah, God's going to hear your cry. It doesn't sound like a stern rebuke like we see in chapter 32. That's what I'm wanting you to see. All right, now let's talk about the Levites. More is said about Levi. So what did you put in answer to question number 3? What is that? C. All right. Yeah, they're chosen to be the leaders and have temple service. So let's flag some things as we go along. Let your Thummim and your Urim, now we've talked about that over in the book of Exodus and Numbers, so we're not going to go back into that. That was a means of communicating with God. The Urim and the Thummim was kept in the vestment of the priest, high priest. And exactly how that took place, we don't know. But it was a means of communicating with God, consulting God through the Urim and the Thummim. Let your Urim and Thummim be with your Holy One. I think that Holy One refers to Moses. And you say, why? Because whom you tested at Massah, that's Exodus 17, remember complaining about the lack of water, and whom you contended with at the waters of Meribah, that's Numbers 20. Another case where they rebelled against Moses. So you will will be able to consult with God because it's out of the tribe of Levi, the high priest is going to come. All right? Then notice verse 9. I take verse 9 to be a statement that Levi the descendants of Levi, the Levites, in other words, will put obedience and service to God above family, who says of his father and his mother, I have not seen them, nor did he acknowledge his brothers or know his own children, for they observed their word and kept your covenant. That sounds to me like they're going to put service to God superior to family, because it's as if they don't know their father and mother, haven't seen their father and mother, but they are set on keeping the commandments of God. Another practical lesson. Service to God exceeds any family relationship. Now, verse 10, they shall teach Jacob. So the Levites will be involved in doing some teaching of the law. They'll put incense on you and the burnt sacrifice on your altar. They're going to be involved in tabernacle service. And then verse 11 sounds like that they're going to have enemies to be defeated, that God will strike the loins of those who rise against him, and against those who hate him, they will not rise again. So God will defeat their enemies. So more is said about Levi than perhaps any of the other tribes, perhaps because they're involved in temple service. And so they're going to communicate with God. They're going to be dedicated to their service. They're going to teach tabernacle, be involved in tabernacle service, and their enemies will be defeated. Anything else you see? Do you see, I want to go back and emphasize this point again. Do you see the value of this chapter after the seemingly stern rebuke of 32 of the song? Instead of coming back with the same, Connie Adams and I worked together years ago in a two-preacher deal, and I was a young preacher in my 20s, and he kept emphasizing, when you got to hit something, hit it and hit it hard, and then back off of it and deal with something else. Rebuke them, chapter 32, rebuke them hard, encourage them now. And that goes a long way. You need to be rebuked. There is apostasy coming, but you have great potential. There's value in that. All right. Well, we'll stop and sermonize a little more later on. Let's go to Benjamin now. What is said about Benjamin? All right. In other words, he has protection and safety. Again, if we're looking for great details, it's not there. He will dwell in safety, verse 12, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. That's some form of protection or shelter. It may give the idea of God carrying Benjamin on his shoulders. And so God bears him and protects him, but it's just a statement of God's protection and safety upon Benjamin. All right, let's talk about Joseph, starting at verse 13 through verse 17. A little more said about Joseph than some of the others. What about Joseph? All right, there's going to be a well-established, there's going to be strength and abundance. While a number of verses are here, not a great number of details. Now, Joseph stands for the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. So you had a half a tribe of Manasseh on one side of the river, the other half on the other, and then you had Ephraim. So that's really three regions that as they settle into the land. So let's start at verse 14. Verse 14, God's going to bless them with precious things. Verse 13, precious produce and the best things of the ancient mountains and precious things from the everlasting hills. In other words, Ephraim and Manasseh are going to be well established, number one. They're going to have favor with God, favor of him who dwelt in the bush. They're going to stand in favor with God. God's going to bless them richly. Then when we get to verse 17, his glory is like the firstborn bull. The horns are like the horns of a wild ox. In other words, he's going to have strength, and there's going to be abundance. And that's about all that's said about Joseph. Joseph is going to abound. Joseph is going to have blessings. Joseph is going to be well established. Joseph is going to have strength, and Joseph is going to have favor with God. All right. Let's go to Zebulun and Issachar. Now, they're grouped together, 18 and 19. What's said about Zebulun, first of all? Verse 18. Rejoice in your going forth or going out. Well, that probably has reference to trade success. They will have success in trade, which they did. And Issachar in your tents. One writer suggests that that may have reference to agricultural success. And you say, well, I don't think so. Well, okay, it's some success, so we'll leave it at that. They were agriculturally successful. Zebulun was successful in trade, so this seems to be a pronouncement on those areas of success, but if not, then that some area of success is pronounced upon Zebulun and Issachar. In other words, they're going to prosper. So at verse 19, they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness, and they shall partake of the abundance of the seas and the treasures hidden in the sand. I don't know that that means literally treasures in the sand, but it's like they're going to be successful as if gathering treasures out of the sand or out of the sea. They're going to be prosperous. Things are going to go well for Zebulun and Issachar. Now let's go to Gad. What do we learn about Gad? Military power. That's the main thing that's mentioned here. Blessed is the one who enlarges Gad, dwells like a lion. He tears the arm, and he comes with the heads of the people. I'm reading at verse 21, and administers justice and his judgments with Israel. It seems to be military power and might. And so Gad's going to have that strength. Now, there's a great deal of question about Dan, and I'll try to flag what that is as it's not a very long verse, but there's a lot of question as to the meaning of that. What's said about Dan, verse 22? Is a lion's whelp, and he shall leap from Bashan. Now, we know what it says. What we don't know is what it means. It seems to point to a possibility of a couple of things. Some think that it's pointing to the possibility of apostasy. And other writers have suggested that this is talking about your lion's whelp, which suggests the idea perhaps of being immature, like a young lion. It's not like a fierce lion, a mature lion. It's a young lion, and that he shall leap from Bashan. So perhaps those two go together because of immaturity. There may be some degree of apostasy. Or it may have reference to immature behavior. Or some have suggested that, I believe it was Bible Knowledge Commentary, I don't know what I did with that, but suggest that this has reference to their eagerness and the vigor with which they go into battle. That they'll be like a young lion that is immature, that's eager to go into battle without being fearful. So it may have to do with their fearlessness and immaturity. Now, I probably confused you, so I've got you right where I was. So, our minds are together, if you're confused on that.
A lot of these prophets from Genesis 49.
Yes.
It talks about being the serpent, the serpent in the way of the viper, by path, and by the horse's tail, so that the rider falls back.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. That in Jacob's statement there, Jacob pictures it's like a viper that bites the horse's heel, and that here it's perhaps a very similar concept of this immature lion that is ready to attack, whether it's wise or not to do that. I think it's by being a lion's whelp probably has reference to something about that immature lion. He's either got a lot of energy to do something, or immaturity, and I want to think it's immaturity that he's talking about, in light of Genesis 49. All right, let's go on and dealt with Naphtali. Naphtali, what can we say about it?
It was three great
They're going to have a great abundance. They'll be full of blessings of the Lord, possessed from the west and the south. And then Asher, last of all, 24 and 25. Yeah, they have great prosperity, and they're going to have children. There are going to be many children. In other words, they're going to grow, and they're going to be physically prosperous, and there's going to be security. Now, notice that your sandals shall be iron and bronze. I believe it was Wiersbe that suggests perhaps that the sandals there stand for their gates. But be that as it may, it's like they either have sandals of iron or gates of iron. It gives the idea of some sense of security, stability, and they're going to have that. So they have all of those blessings. All right, so as verses 1 to 5 serves kind of as an introduction to these blessings for each tribe. What a way to end Moses' last speech, to talk about this tribe gets this blessing, this tribe gets this blessing, this tribe gets this blessing, and this tribe gets this blessing, and this tribe, and we're blessed because we have the law of God. Then he ends that with the happiness of a blessed people. So they're on the verge of going into the land of Canaan, crossing over to take Jericho first. That's what we're getting into starting next week. We won't be to Jericho there, but we'll be talking about the conquest. All right? So they've already spent 30 days for this series of four sermons. We're going to get in chapter 34. There's going to be 30 days of mourning, and then we're ready to roll into the conquest. So we're on the verge of that. So with that in mind, what does he say in verse 26 and 27? God is going to, look at verse 27. Yeah, God's going to thrust out your enemy before you. By the way, Jeshurun is mentioned again, chapter 32, 15. If you have a note there, that's righteousness, stands for Israel. There is none like this God. In other words, his excellency is in the clouds. He's a mighty, powerful God. He's going to thrust your enemies out. So, and then he mentions, notice the word safety in verse 28, Israel shall dwell in safety, and happy are you, O Israel, and who is like you, a people saved by the Lord. So here's the picture of the happiness of a blessed people. He's pronounced the blessings upon them, and that's conditioned on their following that law, verses 1 to 5. And there's happiness, and God's going to drive your enemies out, and you're going to dwell safely, and you're going to be happy, and things are going to go well for you. That's conditioned on you following the law, and he's done. Moses is done. Now, we'll come back to that sermon here in just a second. Let's see if we can get through chapter 34. Chapter 34 deals with the death of Moses. Let's see what we learn about the death of Moses. Verses 1 to 4, he was allowed to go up, and he went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo. All right, we'll come back to that outline in a second. Here's where we are, right here at close to Beth Peor. This is the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. You have Jericho right here. I know the writing's a little small, but I tried to blow this up where we could see the relationship. They're about to cross over the Jordan River. This is the Jordan River here, march toward Jericho. So we're right here, and this is the land of Moab, just to the south of that. He makes his way up to Mount Nebo. And what does God show him? He's able to look across because of the height of Mount Nebo. He can see the entirety of the land, all the way from Dan down below Judah. He can see the whole region. And God says to him, this is the land, verse 4, that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to your descendants. And I've caused you to see it with your eyes, but you'll not cross over there. You're not going to see it. But yeah, I mean, you're not going to experience it, but you've seen it, and you can see every bit of it. And I told you could see the land. You've seen it now, and that's all you get to do. All right. Now, at verse 5 through 7, what do we read? Yep. He died in the land of Moab according to the word of the Lord. In other words, the Lord had said it's going to happen. It happened. It wasn't a prediction. It was a prophecy. And they buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite of Beth Peor. All right, the word opposite there means in front of or against. I know that helps a lot, but again, you're right there where I am and your understanding of that. It just means it wasn't right at Beth Peor. It's in front of or somewhere in that vicinity. And so do we know where he was buried? No. Anyone who claims they do, no, then they're lying because no one knows according to this text. Now, it makes you wonder, do you remember there being an argument over the body of Moses? Jude verse 9. Who was the argument with? Satan and, the angel who argued over the death, over the body of Moses. It may be the location. I don't know what the argument was about. We don't know where he was buried. But somewhere against, near, or in front of Beth Peor is where he died, and that's where he was buried. How old was he? 120 years old. What about the condition he was in when he died? Still had some vigor. We talked about that last week, that he was perhaps not of the condition to be the leader to go into these battles they're about to go into, but he wasn't that he was old and feeble and about ready to give out anyway. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor abated. But the reason he died is not out of old age. He died because God said it was time for him to die. Because he disobeyed, Numbers 20. All right. Now then, let's get verse 8. What does Israel do? Mourn for Moses for 30 days. And so for 30 days there was weeping and mourning for Moses. And when it was ended, now we have at verse 9. What happens at verse 9? Joshua comes into the picture. Question number 6. How did they react to this new leader? Say again. Yeah, they obeyed him. Exactly. They took heed to him. And Moses had laid his hands upon him to symbolize the power has been passed. And he has the spirit of wisdom upon him. And he's the leader as was Moses. And as God had directed Moses that he would be the leader. Now the book ends with a tribute to Moses. What does the tribute say? Question number 7. All right, very good. So God had dealt with Moses face to face. That will not be the same with Joshua, not in the same sense. And so there hasn't been a prophet, but God would raise up a prophet like unto Moses, and that is fulfilled in Christ, the Messiah. Acts 3 will tell us that. So it's just telling us that Moses was the man that God had worked with the mighty wonders and signs coming out of Egypt and the wonders and signs that Moses performed in the sight of all of Israel. And that's how the book ends, of him being a great prophet. He died, he's dead, he's buried, and we're ready to move on to another book. All right, here's a summary of the 4 sermons. You have obedience based upon the past. You have the repeating of the law and the details of the law. In the 2nd sermon, the 3rd one was the renewal of a covenant. And here in the 4th, we got a new leader now. And here are the future challenges. You're going into a land, there's going to be apostasy. There is great potential though. And he's done. So if this had been a gospel meeting of 4 sermons, what do you think? Let's have him back next year. All right, yeah, let's have him back. Maybe there's one sermon you like a little better than the other one. Maybe one captivates your thoughts just for a moment. One last question. I always like to ask this. I don't think I asked this here. I like to ask at the end of a book. What's impressed you the most this time about the book of Deuteronomy? And that I answer that differently every time I study a book. What stood out is this really impressed me the most? That's a good point. Yeah, it's just repeatedly, in every sermon, but almost every chapter, something about obedience. What's impressed you the most about this book, this time? Very good, very good, very practical. What's impressed you the most? Good point. God kept his word. He's bringing them to the land. He said, Moses, you're not going to go. He kept his word. God means what he says, doesn't he? Yeah. I think the emphasis, as Annie Lou said, about obedience has hit me more this time than it has. I've seen that before. I've underlined it. I go back and I see I have had notes on obedience, but how many times that's mentioned stands out, perhaps more than any other time. Anything else? We are done. Joshua 1, next time.